Hey, this is Matt Markin, and in episode 45 of the Adventures in Advising podcast, we chat with Ryan Sheckel and Dr. Karen Archambault. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And if you don't already, check us out on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok at Advising Podcast, and YouTube at Adventures in Advising. Without further ado, here's episode 45.
Welcome to episode 45 of Adventures in Advising. It's our 20th episode of 2021.
Yes, sir. Episode 45. And I'm going to turn it back over to you, Colm. In case anyone missed the last episode, there was some news that was given about the future of the podcast and us as hosts. So spoilers ahead.
This will be my final episode as co-host. As I mentioned in the last episode, I'm going to be on the road quite a bit for the foreseeable future and therefore unable to dedicate the time needed to the podcast. But I am leaving it in Matt's capable hands and I want to wish him continued success. The past 2 years have been brilliant. Over the course of 45 episodes, I've had the opportunity to speak with more than 100 people from around the globe, to learn from them and to be inspired by them. Thank you to all those guests who joined us, and a special thank you to you, our listeners. I have enjoyed this experience immensely, and I know that I will carry it with me into the future.
Very well said. And hey, the chair is always there if it works out in your schedule to return back, even if it's an interview here and there. It's definitely been a blast doing this together for 45 amazing episodes, and good luck to you on all the cool things that are going to be coming up. But of course, the show must go on, and let's get to it, I guess. And here's our interview with our very first guest ever on this podcast, and that's with Ryan Sheckel. Back to the podcast, Ryan Sheckel, who's the Assistant Director of Pre-Professional Health Careers at Texas Tech University. Longtime listeners will remember Ryan has appeared on the podcast before, and now for his third interview. And his first interview was on our very first podcast episode. So Ryan's first interview discussed his presentation at the 2019 NACADA Annual Conference, the Academic Advising Approaches book, and also a little bit about pop culture. In Ryan's second interview, we chatted about his background in higher ed, being the Assistant Director at Texas Tech, the history of Texas Tech's mascot, more about presentations, more about pop culture, and his time at the 2020 virtual NACADA conference. All this was from episode 22 of the podcast. Now we have Ryan back to chat with some more. Ryan, how are you?
I'm doing great, Matt. It's good to see you again in a way that is becoming far too familiar. I enjoyed seeing everybody as well in person in Cincinnati.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. It was just great being back to seeing people after 2 years. It wasn't as awkward as I thought it was going to be, but I thought, yeah, I had a great time. And it's been almost a year since we've had a podcast interview with you. So what's new with you? What's new at Texas Tech University?
Well, we have been on campus as an advising office since August of 2020. But this fall semester was sort of our institution's return to fully in-person offerings. I know I haven't done the research on it, but I know that we still have more virtual and hybrid modality options than I think would be considered normal, pre-pandemic normal. But, you know, as far as percentages go, the vast majority of on-campus housing, you know, on-campus programming is all returning to what people are thinking of as normals. And so that's been interesting. You know, the energy definitely feels different than last fall semester. We've met with students, I would still say probably at least half still virtually, but meeting with students in person is something we haven't done in a while, and we're doing that too, and sorting through how do we do that appropriately and safely. But, you know, it definitely feels, we had our first major on-campus recruiting event yesterday. And that type of energy is something that we haven't had in a long time. And, you know, coming off of a fantastic conference and stuff, returning to a big on-campus event, it's still not normal, but there's definitely a lot more energy and effort in that in-person space.
How was your energy coming from being at the conference presenting and then flying back and then going right into presentations for students?
Well, I have to say, I know for so many folks that travel was disrupted significantly Saturday and Sunday. And I was fortunate that that was not the case for me. I was definitely tired. I remember sleeping a lot Saturday night and into Sunday morning. And then we went and did some stuff and got lunch and had some time with the family, came back to settle in for a little bit of a moment of time in between things and falling asleep on the couch. And it had nothing to do with the game that I was watching, but I'm still tired. So not only did we have a recruiting event on Monday, yesterday morning, but then that was like 8 to noon. But then also my class that I teach is Monday afternoons. And I was sitting on like the little stage that is in the room that I teach in. And normally when I start class, as people are filtering in and logging in top hat and taking attendance that way, I usually stand. But I was not about standing. So there's a chair and I was sitting in the chair and one of the students came in and he was looking around like he wasn't sure if he was in the right place. And so I just asked him, I was like, do you think you're in the wrong place? And he's like, well, it's Monday, right? And I was like, yeah, and it's 2 o'clock. This is seminar in health professions. And he goes, okay. I was like, is it weird because I'm sitting down? And he's like, maybe. So I was like, I was just too tired. I almost taught class sitting down, but I have a hard time lecturing sitting. So I eventually did. But I was home early yesterday, and I was in bed early yesterday, and recovering from a fantastic time, for sure.
Yeah, don't get me started on travel and flight cancellations. That was me over the weekend, but, you know, we're back at it.
Right.
Talk about your class again, because what class are you teaching and how's that going this semester?
So when I took my position as assistant director for pre-health advising, the former director was teaching a seminar in health professions class. And the idea is, for pre-health students, let's introduce them to the range of roles and professions and fields and perspectives in actual professional schools, medical schools, pharmacy schools, and so on. Interprofessionalism is a big part of their curricular model. And so there's a benefit to the pre-health student to understand their own professions, of course, but also how their profession will interact with, relate to, and benefit from other professional fields. So there's multiple learning outcomes for the course, but one of them is understanding interprofessionalism. Another is understanding how to be a strong applicant for professional school. And ultimately, I've added to really understand themselves, which those go hand in hand. So we're currently in a phase of the course, the middle third, where we're talking about self-assessments and developing a vocabulary and sense of self. So it's learning about your profession, learning about yourself, and learning about healthcare in general. Previously, the way the course was taught was that we'd have speakers from sort of each of the professional fields each week, and they'd be there live. They'd do their talk. I would try to influence those lectures as much as I could to really personalize the speaker and tell their story and how they became a healthcare professional and not just recruit for their programs. And this year, it's not that I don't appreciate those speakers' time and energy, but where it's scheduled during the day, it's not particularly convenient for them. And I was really looking to make the course a little bit more of something that I was contributing as instructor and not just scheduling speakers. So I have all those lectures from previous semesters recorded. And so I was like, I'm going to flip the class. So on Blackboard, that's our learning management system. I'll post the lecture the Tuesday after we meet for the next week. They watch the lecture, they take a quiz, they have a forum discussion post where they respond to other people and to my prompt. And then I give a lecture that sort of wraps it up and encapsulate it, usually 3 or 4 main points from the recorded lecture. And usually they're about similar topics built around our elements of competitive and compelling, things like understanding your profession, understanding your sense of passion, information literacy, and those sorts of things. So I've changed the way the course is taught, which means I have to work a lot harder this semester. But it's been really good for me. I've mentioned multiple times in my sort of summary lectures at the end of the week, that hearing the lectures again and listening for that content or reading that content in a new way for a new purpose has really broadened and deepened my understanding of the course and how we try to reach those outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of more work on you, but a lot of benefit to the student, though, and utilizing what you already have. So the recordings with the speakers, flipping that approach, and then adapting your class based off the time of day it is. So I think that's really awesome. Now, we were talking earlier about travel prior to that, the conference. So just recently, Nakata had their 2021 annual conference, both a virtual component, but both of us got to attend in person after 2 years. Any takeaways for you now that you kind of get a little bit of time to reflect back on last week?
People talk about the pandemic and the ways that it's disrupted our thinking, the opportunities rethink how we share content or how we interact with our stakeholders. Typically, when we talk about those things, and understandably, our actual day jobs, what we're paid to do, that's usually the perspective that I take. I've been asked multiple times, what thing did you do or what strategy do you use during the pandemic that you think will persist, that you'll retain or whatever. But I will say that for the purpose of the conference and takeaways is because it was hybrid and because there were on-demand and recorded sessions recorded live there, that the conference isn't really over. We're not attending live or synchronous things anymore, but we have asynchronous access to this content, things that I wasn't able to attend because I was attending something else I wanted to attend. And so I don't know if it will persist, if we'll continue to record on-demand versions of our sessions in advance of in-person conferences. But that's kind of an interesting idea. As I was traveling on my way back, I was thinking about the sessions that were either recorded in advance of the conference or recorded live that I wanted to watch or maybe even watch again, which is something that's never happened before. It didn't really change the way I approached attending the conference. It's not like I was like making choices about which one is recorded and which one isn't. I went to the sessions I wanted to go to most, but I realized I have an opportunity post conference to stretch the conference out in content. Previously, I'd made the pitch that the best thing to do or the best takeaway from a conference is that you don't have to end the conferencing, the interaction with colleagues. And now the content doesn't have to end either. That's sort of interesting. I would say that the biggest shift or change to how I approach the conference in person, though, was the fantastic and amazing development of the scholarly papers session. Obviously, being a part of that, as sort of like the task force or work group that was getting that to from idea to realization. I already knew about it, but I would say as an attendee, that's definitely a session type and an approach to being at a conference that was brand new and fascinating and really beneficial to me as an attendee.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Insights into Teens, a podcast series exploring the issues and challenges of today's youth. Talking to real teens about real teen problems. Explore issues from braces to puberty, social anxiety to financial responsibility. Each week, we talk about the topics concerning today's youth. We look at how the issues affect teens, how to cope with these issues, and how parents, friends, and loved ones can help teens handle these challenges. Check out our video episodes on youtube.com/insightsintothings. Catch our audio versions on podcast.insightsintoteens.com or on the web at insightsintothings.com.
Do you happen to know if those sessions were recorded, the scholarly paper sessions?
They were not. And I'll say that if certainly I don't speak for everybody on the group, but I don't think that they would disagree that just the work of getting those sessions to happen was for the first time ever for Nakata, and under the format and structure of having two papers with a discussant after the authors reviewed their papers and their research, and then doing Q&A. There were enough moving parts as it was for the first time around. And because also the purpose of scholarly paper sessions is to, in part, help authors develop their papers as they lead to publication, there's some interest in keeping those still somewhat protected as far as the content and the information. Not that, and I'm sincerely mean this, for anyone who has presented a non-scholarly paper session, which has been the dominant and continues to be the dominant session type, can't publish or isn't thinking about those things. But that is very much the intent behind a scholarly paper session type. Is to develop those papers for publication. So besides trying to pull it off for the first time in the format that we're pulling off, and also wanting to make sure that we're being careful and cognizant of and conscientious about our authors and their research at this point, there wasn't any recorded. There was the possibility that papers would be uploaded to the app. And so there may be some of those sessions types where the papers are uploaded. But any of the scholarly paper sessions that I was in, other than the one I moderated, I also live tweeted those. So you can go look for any of those threads from those scholarly paper sessions if you want to get a peek into what they're like.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of like misconceptions with writing and doing scholarly, turning like, let's say, a presentation potentially into some type of article or publication. I know Dr. Wendy Troxell always says, record your presentations, and that's literally like your first draft of an article. But I think a lot of people think, oh, that's not me. That's not something I can do. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, certainly. There are times when people talk to me about sort of my presence in this space, not just this podcast space but the academic advising space, NACADA, and that kind of stuff. And they assume, I think, maybe it's because of the way I talk about things or my presentations, that's just comes naturally to me. It certainly doesn't. I don't know if it's because my background is in education and I was first ever thought about ideas and content from how I would relay it to students or to learners. But I think around outlines and lesson plans and ultimately presentations, that's the first way that my brain creates something that I'm going to share with other people. I share a lot of ideas that are far less formed, but if I think about something formalizing, my first place that I think about it formalizing is in a presentation or an instructional mode. And I also, because I tested well, never took a college writing course. And so when I had assignments, you know, in graduate school or in, you know, junior, senior level coursework in my undergrad, my papers, they were fine. You know, it wasn't like I was a fantastic writer, certainly wasn't recognized for the strength or proficiency of my writing. And so getting to the point of, I've got an idea, I can see a presentation in it, and then I'm going to translate it to a written product, is those are steps that not only are there my own personal development and issues that are in the way, but there's also work and life and finding the time to do those things. And also the skills. So I think, you know, yes, there are some folks for whom writing will come naturally, and there are some folks for whom writing will be their first product. And that's fantastic. If that comes naturally to you, you're going to find the opportunities a little bit more accessible. But I will say, as someone who's been advising for now nearly 20 years and presenting since 2003 at annual conferences, my first published piece was something that you and I did together after last year's virtual annual conference. So it's doable. It just means that there may be some time and development. Part of that was signing up for a NACADA writing group. And that was really helpful to go into a space where other people had similar goals and interests, but were also looking for support and help. And so finding collaborators, finding support, and seeing the possibility, but also leveraging technologies. I know that a lot of the stuff that you and I worked on and are continuing to work on came from an actual recording, a transcription using otter.ai. Eventually I need to get some sort of sponsorship from them. But you know, a way of getting the words from our mouths to the screen or to the paper, so to speak, you know, it may not come naturally, but there are lots of ways that you can start to build that proficiency. And reviewing as well. I'm a reviewer for the Nakata Review. I've reviewed for a Frontiers in Education publication. Certainly reviewed plenty of conference proposals. I think I'm now beginning to understand what writing looks like in different settings and different opportunities to publish.
Yeah, and also it's a process. So I know society nowadays, you want everything done like absolutely right then and there, get it done within a day or however long. But it's something that is going to be, you have a starting point, and that end might be weeks away, months away, year away. But you keep working at it, and you'll get it done. But I do want to jump into the Cincinnati conference, because not only did you present, but one of the things that, as of the Cincinnati conference, you are now the new chair of the Theory, Philosophy, and History of Advising community through Nakata. So first, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And aside from the title of the advising community, listeners may want to know, they wanted to know about the various types of advising communities within Nakata. So I think this will be a great opportunity to talk about this one. How would you describe the Theory, Philosophy, and History of Advising community?
Well, so when I was an advisor in our School of Art and was the only advisor in my building, the only person doing the job that I did in my academic unit, I was really starting to sort through, is this a long-term profession? I had taught for a couple years. I'd been in advising for a while. I'd changed roles in advising. And I was like, what am I getting? What is this profession doing to satisfy my values and my passions and my interests? Certainly, I really enjoy the interaction with students in an educational setting. Definitely enjoy the campus culture and all that stuff. But I was like, long term, what does a career in advising look like? And up until that point, like I said, my first annual conference was 2003. I presented a pre-conference session and then two concurrent sessions. I didn't know any better. So I was involved in the association, but I wasn't doing things like attending the town hall business meeting. I wasn't going to advising communities at the time. They were called commissions and interest groups. I was attending sessions, learning things, and then sort of finding the people I came to the conference with. So in 2013, I decided, I'm going to do more. This is a very armchair, amateur sort of maybe perhaps misunderstanding of the year of yes concept. But I was like, I'm just going to say yes to things. I'm just going to say yes to possibilities and be open to it. And so I attended my first Theory, Philosophy, and History commission meeting at that annual conference. And I was like, oh, they're talking about the ideas that I'm interested in. It's not that there aren't other advising communities that I'm a member of or that I find interesting. And we certainly can talk about that later. But Theory, Philosophy, and History, sitting in that meeting and listening to the things that they were talking about, I was definitely thinking, these are the folks I want to get to know. These are the conversations I want to have. They're conversations that are ultimately idea-based in a lot of ways. It's not that they don't then translate to practice, but the philosophies that inform how we can practice do the work or approach the work that we're doing, the theories that then inform our strategies and our approaches, and our histories. In particular, I did a post-bac certification in history, and I really love to get to the root of things. So sort of where did this begin? What was its origins? And then sort of understand its evolution and change. And so those are the topics that Theory, Philosophy, and History of Advising community tends to bring into that space. I mean, a lot of that is represented in scholarly publication or presentations of that nature. But a lot of times developments and changes and things that are happening in higher education and in our society and our world around them are very relevant to the conversations that we're having. Like I said, those deeper, meaningful conversations. And it's not that practice and strategy and approach isn't deep or meaningful to people. It's just what I was looking for and needing to connect with. And it was in that advising community or I found it. Because I was saying yes to things and the opportunity has presented itself to be a steering committee member, I was like, yeah, let's do that. And so, since 2014, I've been on the steering committee for the Theory, Philosophy, and History of Advising community, and seeing other people lead in that space was really helpful to get a sense of what does contribution look like. It doesn't necessarily have to be those sort of standard models. It can be more relational. It can be more aspirational. And those were things that were always interesting to me as well. So our community, you know, just as the name says, talks about those things, tries to find where people are having purposeful and interesting interactions around those topics. And then also is doing everything we can to encourage members in all the advising communities to understand the theories, philosophies, and histories and inform those perspectives as well.
And for you as chair, it's a two-year commitment?
It is, yeah. And, you know, what's weird is on the front end when, you know, thinking about nomination, thinking about accepting a nomination, thinking about the running, I was thrilled to have someone else to run against. Me personally, I think that running unopposed, when it comes to organizational health, if elections and some level of competition in the marketplace of ideas is part of what your organization does, if you're running unopposed, that there's in some ways, not that anyone who ran unopposed is not legitimate in their leadership role, but there's somehow a loss there. Donahoe Rankin was ran against me, and that was fantastic. We had a meet the candidates meeting where other people could hear our perspectives and our platforms, what we're going to do. But all of that on that front end made the 2 years seem significant. And not that it's not, but going to the conference and conducting the business meeting, our outgoing chair, CJ Venable, wasn't able to attend. And so I was conducting that meeting. We did include them, though, by Zoom in the meeting, and put the microphone down on my laptop camera or speaker, and we made it work. But actually conducting that business meeting for the first time, I was like, this is going to go so fast. This is going to fly by. Once you start thinking about, okay, we're going to plan quarterly meetings for the steering committee members, and we're going to have quarterly either Zoom or some other type of content available, ideally partnered with other advising communities. And then we're going to have sort of the natural rhythm of conference proposals, proposal reading and reviewing, and then selection, and then an annual conference. You already realize how fast your first year is going to go. And so I'm excited about the opportunity, and I'm anxious to make sure that we make the most of it, of these 2 years. I'm also anxious to make sure I honor the responsibility that a chair position provides me. It's going to go fast.
Yeah, and I know you just started in the position, but any thoughts so far and any goals you want to accomplish maybe within this year?
Yeah, I one of the things it's important to know is being on the steering committee, I've seen multiple chairs, and everyone has had their own approach to leading this community. But given the tight window of chairs, tenures, I decided that I didn't necessarily want to set my own priorities. We have a lot of fantastic folks, big thinkers and strategic thinkers and creative thinkers and critical thinkers. And so I wanted to harness that opportunity and the resources available. And so we started our business meeting in Cincinnati in person, but we'll conclude it virtually on November 11th. I was just asking, you know, based on my background in organizational theory, that we identify three priorities for this year, and that we organize ourselves around those priorities. So some came out during conversation. Definitely the role of history. We're at a unique place as an association that so many of the people who've been influential and critical in the development of academic advising and the association are here and happy and willing and excited to share their perspectives in the history and growth of academic advising and the association. That focus on history definitely sounds like it will be one of our priorities. The other thing that I was thinking about as a priority is that there are voices that are going unheard in theory, philosophy, and history, whether they're underserved populations, underrepresented populations, marginalized populations, or there are people in the association who feel like they have an interest, but that couldn't be them because they haven't done things. They're too new, or they focus on one thing for, you know, too long or whatever. So trying to find a way to broaden access to theory, philosophy, and history as a conceptual base. But that's only two. That's only two priorities that I could say we've begun to identify. And so our goal for our November 11th conclusion of our meeting is to let's finalize our priorities. Let's get some work groups established. Steering committee members will be a part of leading those groups, but so will members of the advising community. And I'd really like to produce some tangible results in each of those priority areas.
And how does one join if they're interested, whether it's this advising community or any NACADA advising community?
Right. So when you log into the NACADA website, if you're a member, there will be a tab that says My Communities in your sort of member profile. And you can edit and review those. The association allows people to select four advising communities. And so you can add theory, philosophy, and history, and then three others. And because you'll have that sort of tag on your member account, when official communication goes out through the association about a specific advising community, you'll be included in that communication. On our community page, though, there is also a listserv. And the instructions are on that page on how to join the listserv. I think everyone has feelings about listservs. I think for the theory, philosophy, and history of advising community, making the listserv be relevant is really our biggest concern. As a communication channel, I think there are times when we have energy in that channel, and there are times when we don't. But I can conclusively say I have never said that the listserv for theory, philosophy, and history has been a distraction or a problem. If anything, I'd like to see a little bit more activity there. So signing up for our listserv is not going to spam your inbox with tons of pointless emails where we're debating Foucault or something like that, which is a philosopher, for those who don't know. But it's another way to connect with us. We're finally also on Facebook. The Advising Philosopher is a Facebook group that our community created a while back as another way of engaging with members.
Maybe it'll be on TikTok next. I don't know.
I'll say this. There are some members, and they know who they are, of our advising community who absolutely need to do some TikTok dance videos for us. So.
Now, I assume that with the chairing this advising committee, that's one of yours that's on your membership. Do you mind sharing what the other ones that you're a part of?
Sure. So since we advise health profession students, I've been a part of the health professions advising community since 2015. When I joined here, I updated my community membership. That community also has a sort of a reciprocal or a related connection with the NAAHP, the National Association of Advisors for Health Professions. And so those two communities sort of feel like they're cousins in ways of the advising community and NAAHP. But then I'm also, as an administrator, looking for another gap in my personality to be filled, and that's my lack of proficiency in assessment. So I've been a part of the assessment advising community. And then also because I lead a team of five pre-health advisors, primary role staff advisors, advisor training and development has been a community that I've been a part of. And really appreciate the leadership of Gavin Farber in that role. Excited to see what's going to be developing in theory philosophy, advisor training and development in the coming years after that really rich period of Gavin's chair.
And maybe you'll know where I'm going to go with this, but with the advisor training and development, anything interesting that is coming out of that community?
Well, I know that the advisor training and development book publication from NACADA, the second edition was reaching sort of that natural period in time where they're reviewing it and seeing what needs to be updated. And so I was really excited to have a proposal accepted to write a Voices of the Field portion for the theory chapter of that third edition. We've submitted our sort of peer-reviewed, our content editor-reviewed manuscripts to the copy editors. So we're moving into that next phase of the publication process. Which is scary. It's the first time I've ever done anything like that, but it's really exciting. Again, going through that iterative process of turning in a proposal, being selected, and then sort of the edit and review process with our content editors. I learned a ton about my own writing and about writing for audiences. But then moving into copy editing, I'm like, oh, that's so formal and specific. It's my understanding that that third edition will be published in time for the 2022 annual conference in Portland. So be on the lookout for that.
Well, that's exciting. And kind of going back to what I said, it's a process. It takes time, but like you're saying, you're enjoying kind of seeing a lot of this behind the scenes kind of thing and all that's involved in it.
Right. The work and the people who do the work. It's no small task. And if you ever read the acknowledgements portion of any book, they always talk about how much work goes into getting a book on the shelf. That is no less true for these publications. The amount of attention and energy and effort that is poured into these important items in our literature, in our growing profession, being a small part of that and getting just a little bit of a glimpse, you really develop not only an appreciation for the people doing it, but then, you know, I look at my bookshelf and I see how many I've got stacked up behind me right there, and just the amount of work that goes into that, there you develop a different perspective of it, I guess. And certainly, you know, how real it is for the people involved in it, and it becomes more personal.
Yeah. And if you're not watching us on YouTube and you're listening to the podcast, the audio version, he's got a stack of books. And I think the Power Story from Peter Hagen is probably the top one there.
There's definitely no ranking. I'll say that.
It's the one that's on top of on top. The rest of the books.
Right. And then academic advising approaches, the new advisor guidebook, the master advisor text, that sort of trilogy. That's the whole thing that kicked off my crazy Star Wars thing, actually, was that they were releasing a trilogy of books. And I was like, I know trilogies because I know Star Wars.
So if you want Ryan to buy any of your books, if you're selling them, have a trilogy. He will be the first in line.
I'll be there.
So you did a couple presentations as well at the conference. So the one I want to talk to you about with the time we have left is not the narrative one that we did. Now, we can always talk about that at a different time.
You know plenty about that.
But you did one on... Tell me, so you did Communities of Practice, How They Wither and Die, and What to Do About It. Tell me about this presentation.
Sure. For those who know me, I've said multiple times, one of my favorite things to do is subvert expectation. You know, the dominant narrative is always something that I think should be problematized and queried and thought critically about. And even in your own life, right? We develop themes and we become known for something. And certainly I felt like anyway that people who knew of my presentations from previous conferences knew that they were fun, knew that they were pop culture, knew that they would be entertaining in ways. And so when I was developing this presentation, largely it came from one article. It came from something that wasn't even the focus of the article about communities of practice. There was an article from Cox in 2005, I believe, where he was reviewing sort of the status of the idea of communities of practice and how they've been adopted in other disciplines. So it was a literature review, looking at four, you know, significant publications on communities of practice, and just summarizing what you would find in the literature. And there was one column, 75% of one column on one page of this article that had eight items that, drawing off of someone else's work and the application of communities of practice in healthcare, that there were things about the nature of 21st century work that undermined the development of communities of practice. And as I was reading the eight things, I was like, every one of those sounds like academic advising, not just during the pandemic, but especially during the pandemic. So that was the genesis of, I marked it up and I wrote like a bracket and I said, presentation. I was like, right here, these 8 points, this is a presentation. And then, you know, I continued to move on to understanding what communities of practice are. It's an idea of, it's a group of people that share an interest and a common task in a thing that they do, typically the work that they do. And that through their regular interaction, they're seeking to improve how they do that work or that task that they share together. We've seen a couple of people in advising literature and scholarship cite communities of practice as something of value for academic advising. So I was like, well, I hear about it. And every time I've ever talked to somebody about communities of practice, they're like, oh yeah, Levin Banger, like it's good stuff. And I was like, I don't know anything about it. So that's how I went down that rabbit hole. I was like, where did it start? What does it mean? I ran into those eight things that undermine it. And that's how that presentation began. The Western New York Advising Conference went entirely virtual last year. John Sauter is a good friend of mine, and they were looking for conference proposals. And I was like, let's do it. You know, it's coming up. It's going to force me to get those ideas out into something that I can do, which is a presentation, as we've discussed. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to take a completely different tone. I'm going to take a tone that is in ways shocking. And that's how, in my crazy brain, the title came up of how communities of practice don't flourish. Because if academic advising work tends to be in the characteristics or in the structure of these eight things that work against communities of practice, then if we're going to adopt a communities of practice concept, whether in our scholarship or in our practice, we should know about them. We should anticipate them. Instead of sitting back and going, you know, why aren't our communities of practice really taking root and flourishing? We can say, oh, well, there are some things about the nature of advising work that are working against our interests. And that was the idea behind it. I think I was fun. But we did in the presentation, you know, collect some data and see if everyone else felt like these were also characteristics of academic advising.
Yeah. Now, at least in the recorded one that I watched, you had mentioned that when you started advising that, you know, you were in a centralized advising office, and that actually had a big influence on your conception of communities of practice and your approach to academic advising. What was it about having that centralized approach that had that impact for you?
Well, so in the origins of the concept of communities of practice is something called legitimate peripheral participation. Sometimes that looks like mentoring. Sometimes that looks like apprenticeship. Sometimes it just looks like I'm learning on the job alongside others who are proficient. And when I came into the what is now called Explore, the Exploratory Undecided Advising Office in 2002, there were others who were already doing that work who were proficient, and I was new to it. And in having colleagues who I could sometimes inadvertently overhear through our cubicles and sometimes actually shadow and sometimes have meaningful conversations about like that, I didn't know any better. Just like presenting at annual conferences, I didn't know any better. I didn't know any better that there were, I mean, I was aware that there were advisors who weren't in centralized offices or were in advising offices where they were the only advisor. But I grew up, I learned to think of myself as somebody who was in a community of practice. I didn't have that language at that time, but I knew that I could ask somebody for something. I knew I could learn from them. I knew that I could develop around our centralized shared task an identity that says, yes, this is me. This is my work. It's not the job that I do. It's who I am. And fundamentally, if a community of practice is going to flourish and develop, the individuals have to conceive of their shared task as fundamental to their identities, as opposed to the thing that pays the bills. And I know that there are times when we need the thing to pay the bills. But I think if we're going to reach potential as a community of practice or as a professional community, at some point there has to be an aspirational element that says, yes, I'm adopting this as central to my identity. It's not necessary, but I think it is certainly part of becoming something more. So many of the other professions, I think if you spoke to members of those professional fields, separating the work they do from who they are is antithetical to their conception of self. And I'm all about work-life balance, and I understand that there's more to a person than the work that they do. But that relationship is central to the idea of community practice. And growing up or starting my professional journey in a centralized advising practice meant that when I moved out of it, I missed it. And when I moved out of it, as I was searching for it, I found it in a different community through the Theory, Philosophy, and History of Advising community and through NACADA.
Nice. And I wish we could talk more, but we've actually already reached time for this interview.
Just edit it down, Matt. Edit it down.
I wish. But I think another educational interview with Ryan Shuckel, a lot of tidbits that listeners can find in this interview. And Ryan, always appreciate you being on, being so willing to be asked all these questions and talk about the great things that you're doing and moving advising forward. So of course, if anyone has any questions that wants to connect, what's the best way that they can reach out to you?
So my Twitter handle is at RDSCHECKEL. That's RD Shekel. Of course, my email address at our institution's ryan.shekel@ttu.edu. texastechuniversity.edu. Would love to chat always. You know, it's one of the things that I don't know if we'll ever think differently about connecting with people via video chat anymore. But I would love to do that, or just email, or just on Twitter, whatever works best for y'all. I'm happy to have conversations, and I promise I won't talk as much as Matt did during this interview.
Ryan, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This is so awesome. You know, I love this. It's a great support for the advising communities and advisors out there. And you know, I'm really interested to see who else is listening. So if you ever find out that there are folks outside the advising community who are accessing this content to understand what our profession is about, I think that there's some really fascinating things there.
Oh yeah. At the Cincinnati Congress, I've had a lot of people that listen to the podcast, which I was just amazed and looking forward to doing more of these. So cool. Thanks again, Ryan. Always something you can learn listening to Ryan, and best to you on your 2 years as chair for the Theory, Philosophy, and History of Advising community. But before we get to our next interview, let's hear from Dane Zanowski from Temple University and find out what's going on over on Dane's desk on our Adventures in Advising YouTube channel. Dane, take it away.
Hello, Adventures in Advising podcast listeners. This is Dane here to tell you about some new Dane's Desk videos that we have up on the YouTube video channel for Adventures in Advising. First is one of my dear friends and colleagues from Drexel University, Michalina Salavanti, as she talks about some lessons that she learned during the pandemic when advising remotely. And then a new video that we have coming up soon is from Philip Wilkerson. He's an industry advisor at George Mason University. And Philip talks about the importance and the integration of academic advising and career advising. So be sure to check that one out as well. Again, these are Dane's Desk videos that you can find on the Adventures in Advising YouTube channel. Feel free to connect with me through LinkedIn or Facebook if you have ideas for future topics or if you want to be a guest on Dane's Desk. And as always, keep advising.
Thanks, Dane. There's 13 episodes of Dane's Desk to check out on our YouTube channel. Each episode is a mini interview, so you can get a lot of tidbits of info in a short amount of time. And while you're watching those videos, hit that subscribe button and stay up to date.
Coming up now, it's my chat with Karen Archambault. Delighted to be welcoming back a friend of the Adventures in Advising podcast and somebody I am happy to call a friend as well. That is Dr. Karen Archambault, who is Vice President, Enrollment Management and Student Success at RCBC. Karen, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, this has become our annual tradition following the first interview, which was in person at the conference, which is now hard to believe that was a couple of years ago, and obviously virtual since then. How has the past year been for you? It's almost exactly a year, I think, since we were last speaking. So how have the past 12 months treated you?
Well, you know, I think for so many others, I think even though at the time we talked last, we were, just about 6 months into the pandemic. But I think I, like so many other people, still had the belief that this was going to be ending soon. And for me, as a mom of a young child, I was continually hopeful for, you know, school would return to normal and things would return to normal and all that. And so I think a lot of the last year has been spent figuring out what the not normal looked like. I'm not a fan of the phrase of new normal, because that sort of suggests that this becomes that wading our way through a pandemic becomes normal. And I'm not okay with that. But I think it's been a lot of figuring out, what looks good for our students? What do they want? What do they need? You know, we're a commuter institution. So what does it look like when students are with their families and maintaining their all of the things that come with their families in a pandemic? And moving everything to being online and all of those things. I think so much of the last year has been spent in figuring out how to do those things, not as an emergency, but as a part of our reality. And so I think there's a lot to that, to being able to say we're now a year since you and I last spoke, but 18 months since this all began. And I think we're back on campus now full time, for better or for worse, and really figuring out what it looks like to continue to be responsive to our students. For me personally as well, this last year has been an interesting one because my boyfriend and I joke that we weren't able to go anywhere, but we had a lot more time to do things because our kids weren't doing any of their activities. So we spent a lot more time outdoors and we spent a lot more time being able to relax and things that you don't do when everything is moving at a very fast pace. So as much as I don't want to have another pandemic, there's certain good things to be drawn from it as well, in terms of being able to sort of slow down a little bit. And then from an Ekata perspective, when you and I first spoke back in 2019, I think what I told you was that I wanted to take a nap, because that was the end of my presidency. And, you know, any position like that is inherently time consuming and draining in a good way, but still draining. And so in the last year, I've been able to sort of reconnect with Nakata projects without necessarily it being part of Nakata leadership. So we're in the process of finalizing the third edition of advisor training and development. That text started literally weeks before the pandemic shut everything down. Rebecca Hapes and I signed on to be editors of that at the end of February in 2020. And so we're coming up to the end of the intensive writing and editing and development of that text. And then on the heels of that project is the advising administration text that's going to be coming out in 2023. But I'm writing a chapter in that, which I'm very excited about because it's really, for me, it's the connection from Nakata pretty directly to the work that I do every day. And so that's fantastic. And then we've also just institutionally, from my own work at my institution, we picked up a Title III grant, which is a multi-million dollar grant to support institutional change to promote student success. And then we also just recently were awarded a Center of Excellence for Veteran Student Success, which basically allows us to build space and community for our veteran students. And we're also just actually launching in a couple of hours. We are launching our connection with ACE, the American Council on Education, for the Learner Success Lab, which is another initiative to really make institutional change. So it's collaborative across our student affairs units and our academic units to try to really change our institution dramatically. So all that to say that it's been a really busy year. It's despite my comment about having more time to rest, it's also been a very busy year, but I think in very good ways. And I think that's the challenge of a pandemic is to figure out how to survive, how to come through intact, and then to figure out how to make meaning out of it, like it is for so many other things. How do you take it as a learning experience? And so that's kind of where I am right now.
Yeah, so busy as you usually are. And I laugh because, yeah, when I asked you, I said, I think the one of the questions when I was interviewing you at the conference in 2019 was, what next? And you said, a nap. Or and I don't think you've taken a nap since then, Karen, by the sounds of things. Maybe.
Maybe.
But So clearly you have lots of great projects in the work, and I suppose we might come back and touch on some of those. But I am, I suppose, curious. Last year, well, in person, we discussed your presidency. You were just coming to the end of it. Last year, you had a year on to reflect. 2 years on, and you know, I suppose we've had the impact of COVID. We've had, you know, changes at NACADA, and change is inevitable, and you know, change can sometimes be positive, but change, you know, it requires adjustment for everyone. But there is still so much great work being done. But I'm just interested, 2 years removed from being president, reflections on your time, learnings, just for listeners. I mean, we are recording this just about a week before the annual conference, and the opportunity for many people to meet up again potentially for the first time in quite a while. So yeah, just as a former president, always interested in your thoughts.
So I was actually thinking about this the other day, because I was looking at my schedule for the annual conference, and the last time that I was physically at the annual conference, and for probably 6 years prior to that, I almost never made it to a session because my days were so packed with leadership responsibilities, be they meetings or, you know, walk arounds to say thank you or whatever. They were, my schedule was frequently not of my own making. And so as I was looking at the conference this year, I got very excited about the concept that I might be able to see things that were of interest to me and that were directly related to the work that I do. I'm also, quite honestly, you spoke of change, and Melinda is so amazing. And I have had the honor and privilege of working with her for a very long time, because she got her start, and I did, in Region 2 of the association in the Mid-Atlantic region of the United States. And so we've known each other for many, many years. And when I saw that she was selected for the position, I thought what a phenomenal choice that was. And largely because what I have always seen with Melinda is her ability to, first of all, be forward thinking, and to really be thinking about what next, which is my own approach as well. So I love to see that in a person, to never rest on laurels and always be looking for what's the next great way to move a project, or in this case, the association, forward. The other thing that I love about Melinda is that, quite honestly, she's so damn smart. And she is willing to challenge people and challenge assumptions without ever having anyone feel like they weren't a welcome guest in her presence. And so that that combination of things, I'm just so excited to see where the association goes next. And I think there's no question that when someone who has a presence like Charlie Nutt, that they leave incredibly large shoes to fill. And I think of the many conversations I've been in where folks have said that Charlie asked them to be involved, or Charlie identified a way to connect them with someone else, or identified a skill set in them, and all of those things. I think that's so incredibly valuable. But I think in a lot of ways, Melinda is now the right leader to bring us into that what's next. You know, that question of how does the association, now at 14,000 members plus, how does it move to being something that is less dependent on that individual relationship and more able to really move the entire profession forward into, you know, NACADA 2030 or something like that. So I was thrilled to see it. I think it's I think it's such an interesting change to happen during this time when we don't have the ability to physically connect, that we don't, you know, we haven't all been in the same space. And I'll say, quite honestly, whenever I talk about Nakata and I talk about my relationships within Nakata, people who are in other associations think I'm crazy. And I think that's a phenomenon that a lot of us experience, because when I think about folks who I put on the sort of top of my personal list of, you know, the people who I would depend on in, you know, for anything, people I would call at 3 o'clock in the morning and I know they'd answer the phone. If I had to name my top five people, at least two of those spots would be filled by Nakata people. And if I went to my top 10 or my top 20, many more spots would be filled by people from this association. And so the fact that we get to be coming in person and that I get to spend that time connecting, rather than meeting, which, because those are two very different things, that is incredibly exciting to me. And I'm really, really looking forward to flying to Cincinnati next week. Because that is, you know, that one time a year, I frequently feel like it sustains me for a good 6 months or more. After that meeting, I feel like I got my Nakata fix, and then I'm good for a while. So I think that's just right now, you and I talking just before the conference is a very pro Nakata time for me, because I'm so looking forward to those reconnections.
Yeah. And I think there'll be a lot of listeners who, by the time this comes out, the conference will, you know, have passed, but mm-hmm. they will be able to empathize with that. And I can, in terms of what you're saying in relation to Belinda, absolutely. Matt and I were fortunate to speak to her back in April, I think, for our episode that came out just at the beginning of May. And it was a few days after we had done the first interview that it was announced that she would be the new executive director. And she very kindly came back on and gave an additional piece. And just her interaction, her curiosity, her knowledge, and her vision were quite phenomenal. So mm-hmm. I think it is a very exciting time, and any new leader coming in, you know, it's like coming in after a successful coach on a sports team. You got to have your own way of doing it, and it takes a little bit of time, and probably COVID was both a challenge but potentially offered a little bit of a pause where we weren't so much on the treadmill the entire time. So I'm very excited to see what happens over the next few years. And you did mention that, you know, COVID had given you the opportunity to spend, you know, maybe a bit more time outdoors and reflect a little bit. And I'm thinking, you know, for listeners, Karen, especially when you're involved in, say, the third edition of Advisor Training and Development, and also the second edition of the Advising Administration, are there things that, you know, you have learned or taken from the last year, be they COVID, you know, be they in relation to COVID, or just learnings from, you know, your time after being president, that you're kind of going to bring to your work, or that you have brought to your work, or anything, any new approaches, you know, in relation to your work with students? I'm thinking back to, I remember a conversation last year, and you mentioned to me one of the reasons you'd got involved in working in higher ed was that one of your former professors had said to you that you are really good at working with college students. That still remains true, undoubtedly. So always curious to see where you're at, and any learnings you can share with us.
Sure. So I think, you know, my mom and I have an ongoing, I don't know if it's a joke or just a statement on, you know, if it's just her statement on my life. But she has long teased me, probably for, you know, 25 plus years. She has teased me that I don't know how to work unless I'm working at 100. You know, I'm not very good at taking a break. I'm not very good at not having 40 things on my plate. And I have a tendency to say yes, no matter what, you know, and I think it's the inherent helper in me. Somebody asks me to do something and I make the assumption that they're asking because they need my help. And so I step in. And I think the last year has somewhat refocused me. I've said no to more things in the last year, though the people around me would probably question whether that's true or not. But I have said no to more things in the past year than I probably have in the 5 years prior combined. And when I think about the advisor training and development book in particular, there were a couple things that we included in this edition of the book that were not part of the advisor training and development landscape when the last edition came out. And certainly the core competencies is probably the most critical difference between this edition and the last. But the thing that I think is maybe most interesting in the difference in the book is that we included a couple of chapters that were not part of the discussion a few years ago. One is on intercultural competence and intercultural communication. And I think that's so incredibly important in thinking about how we view ourselves as professionals. But even more so from a COVID lens, we have a chapter on mentoring and we have a chapter on self-care as part of professional development. And I think those two chapters really speak to a different kind of view of training and development than the idea that you show up, you receive information, or you receive skills, and then you go and you implement those skills. And so the chapter, and each one of them also has what Nakata calls a voices from the field. So a firsthand account attached to the more theoretical or research-based chapter. And each of those chapters and each of those voices from the field, I think really speaks to the need that so many of us, myself included, realized it, or maybe clarified in the past year, that even when we are in our role as higher education professional, we're also more than that. And we are human at the core of it all. And we are, even when we're looking at advisor training and development, we are human beings with needs. And we have needs for connection, needs for support, and needs for self-care. And so the two voices from the field in particular, the mentoring one was written by Gavin Farber, and the self-care one was written by Jake Rudy. And I think they both really capture the way in which those things about looking out for yourself and having support really supports your students in the end. And I'll say in particular, Jake's voices from the field speaks from a COVID lens. And it speaks from the lens of burnout in the face of COVID. And I think, first of all, I'll just say, I mean, Jake was my ELP mentee, or is, I guess, for the next week. And did such a phenomenal job on this Voices from the Field. I'm incredibly, incredibly proud of him, both as his mentor and as his editor. But I think it really captures that sense of people need to look out for themselves in order to look out for their students. And if nothing else, I think that's what we gained in this past year, is the need to figure out how to avoid burnout before it happens. The need to look at morale, which is something that we are, my institution, my division is diving into head first, because our morale has been incredibly challenged in the last year to year and a half. And so I think those are the spots where I see those connections between like life and work and Nakata, is in the way that that I have needed to refocus. And I will always go back to, and I may have shared this with you last year because I don't remember when it happened. But one of my team members commented to me after a meeting that as the vice president, I'm so much more human now than I was before COVID happened, because my team sees my cats trying to step in the middle of a meeting, and they see my daughter with Barbies just out of, just outside of the view of the camera going, "Mommy, mommy, mommy, can we play now? Can we play now?" And so I think that that recognition of humanity is hopefully the thing that I've gained a little bit more of in the past year. And I hope that both for myself and for the people around me, that that's something I can hold on to as we move forward and we get into whatever the next phase of normal looks like.
I think that's really useful and insightful, and kind of thank you for sharing it. I think it's so needed on both on the mentoring and self-care piece, but when you're talking in relation to intercultural competencies and communication, I suppose that's my hobby horse. I keep banging the drum for we need to do that. Particularly, I feel institutions should do that with our students. I know certainly over here, and I was actually talking to colleagues in the UK about this recently. One of the things we have a tendency to do is when international students come in, we do work with them about culture, and you know, but we do no work with our students, our home students, to say, you know, what culture is and cultural learnings. And if you have a bit, you'll never understand everything, but if you can understand that, you know, why some of the differences exist, it might lead to less frustration. And I think that can go across the board for students and staff and faculty as well. I know one of the other areas that you are involved in, Karen, alongside all your other work, you are involved in teaching as well, if I'm not wrong on that. And just, I suppose, you know, in terms of that, of your work there, and I think it's on a number of different doctoral programs. Is that something that has kind of continued during COVID? Did that the teaching method have to change, or just in relation to that role? Just interested in hearing a little more around that.
Sure. So in the past 20 years or so, I've taught at the undergraduate level, at the master's level, and at the doctoral level, and back in the fall of 2018, so well before COVID started, I stepped away from teaching in the classroom. I continued to teach online, but I stepped away from teaching in the classroom because, quite honestly, it just became too hard to navigate the timeframes and to try to figure out how to be, because my own institution is a community college, so we have the first 2 years of the degree. And I was at that point, you know, I was teaching more advanced classes. I was teaching in a master's program. I was looking at teaching in a doctoral program. And so in the fall of 18, when I came into my current position, I took a step back from teaching in the classroom and went just to teaching online. My online teaching has been at the doctoral level primarily for a few different institutions. Primarily teaching the history of higher education, but also doing work with doctoral students on dissertations. On one of the programs that I work with has an experiential learning component, and so I've worked with students as a mentor in that work. And I'm currently working with a colleague on developing a new course on community college partnerships for a doctoral program that I've been a mentor with and worked with doctoral students on dissertation as well. So the immediate shift wasn't one that I felt because my teaching had already been online. So I didn't have a change in method. What I did have was a change in the way my students experienced class, because they were certainly all used to doing online. You know, they knew what they signed up for. It wasn't a sudden change for them. But they were navigating a lot more in their space about being an online student. So where previously many of them did their online work, you know, we have set times where we still meet. So it's asynchronous. There's a level of synchronous activity to the online course. And many of them would come midday. They would close their office door and they would come during their lunch hour. Well, for many of them, that became more complicated because their lunch hour was also now their kids' lunch hour, or it was the time when their kids had to get logged in to this session or that session for their schools, or it was the time when, you know, a family member, a parent, or an older adult who they were caring for needed some kind of care at that time. So I think there's a, even though we were online, we were always going to be online and we knew we were going to be online, there was still a shift in terms of expectations, not expectations about the quality of their work or even the quantity of their work, but difference in expectations in the way it was done. And that took me a little bit of time to adjust to, purely because in my head it was, well, you knew you were going to be online. We all knew this. We planned for online here. This is different from the times when we had to shift. But I think that all worked out relatively well in the fact that I think everyone has become, or at least I hope that everyone has become, a little bit more forgiving about the ways that our lives and are a lot harder to compartmentalize. It's a lot harder to say my work life is my work life, and then I have my home life, and then I have my student life. Those things overlap a lot more than they used to. The other thing, though, is that this fall, I actually returned to the classroom. So I returned to the face-to-face classroom, just as many institutions are returning to face-to-face classrooms. And that was, that still is very interesting, because I have a very small class. It's a master's level class. It is on history of higher education. But it's also informed differently, not only by COVID, but also because the course has always had a strong equity lens to it. But as I said to my class, 4 years ago, the last time I taught the class, I taught it from this framework, which is a very, white privileged framework of, look how far we've come. And in the last 4 years, my own lens on that content has shifted dramatically, to be less about how far we've come and more about, first of all, how far we haven't come. And second of all, how challenging it is still for our students to be within environments that were never built or intended for them. And it's been a very significant shift for me that dramatically changes the conversations that I have in the classroom. And I think those benefit from being in person, because I think there's a casualness to our in-person conversations, and the way that people use body language and the way that people show up physically in the classroom, that I think is very different than it would have been having those conversations virtually. I see the way that people shift in their seats, or I see the way that they fumble, or they twiddle with their hands. And I can see it now in a way that I don't think I recognized how much I was missing being online. It's interesting, because now I'm, Thursday evenings, I'm back in a face-to-face classroom, and navigating the questions of what happens if a student shows up without a mask, because we are, we're mask required in our classrooms. What do you do with the student who shows up for an evening class without a mask? And how does that student manage being turned away? And then how do you work with that student to navigate that work and all that? So it's really been, it's been a fascinating experience, because I was out of the face-to-face classroom for so long that for me, it's very much about returning to the classroom, but also returning to the classroom that is very different than it was when I left a few years ago.
Absolutely. And I knew we'd get some great insights from just asking that. I think I'm struck by a number of things. I suppose there might be among some people an assumption that, if you were teaching online already, well, sure, how can it possibly have changed? But as you rightly point out, the world changed for everybody. So it didn't matter that, people were used to the online. You were still navigating teaching and learning in a pandemic, and really interesting, I suppose, to hear about the return to face-to-face teaching as well. And probably we're all maybe more more conscious of what's going on in the physical space now, because we have been online, and so the differences between the two are highlighted, and we are more aware. And I think the bravery on your own part in terms of acknowledging that, you know, there are still such a long way for us to go, and there's so much we don't and you know still don't understand, but putting our hands up to acknowledge that and looking at things through a different frame. So I think that's really important that we do that as well. I suppose one of the things, maybe to come back to Karen, that you touched on earlier, and that I'm interested in, and I think maybe listeners would be as well, just because we don't have anything, or maybe it has a different title, but in terms of the Learner Success Laboratory, can you talk a little bit more about, you know, what that is and what that means for the institution and what's involved?
Sure. So this is a project through the American Council on Education. They started this actually during COVID. They started a cohort of 10 institutions. We are cohort number 2. And it's a wide range of institutions. We are the only community college. There is, I believe, 9 of the 10 institutions are from the States, but one is from Mexico. There are private institutions. There are public institutions. They range in size. There's lots of different people, lots of different environments there. And really what the intention is to consider from a strategic lens what it means for an institution to radically change the way that it thinks about student success. It's basically set up with a shared leadership between academics and student affairs, but it is intended to bring together people from all over the institution. So it looks at questions of leadership and structure. It looks at questions of both curriculum and co-curriculum. It looks at questions regarding diversity and equity and inclusion as a lens to consider the entire project. It looks at data and, you know, what does it mean to not just have data, but actively use it? And it's a 2-year project. And it is a project that is, we basically were assigned a coach to guide us through this process, because it's not entirely removed from institutional strategic planning or from an accreditation review or something like that, but it's really about how do you make those kinds of things actionable? How do you make them, how does this report, unlike some of those other things, how is it used as opposed to being something that sits on a shelf? And I'm thrilled because I kind of, you know, I got it in an email one day, and I'm very fortunate that I have a president who, I will say, I don't know of anything that's, you know, that's has an intention of improving the institution that he would say no to. So I went to him and said, this looks really interesting to me. Can I investigate this further? And, I had an interview with ACE, and then got the news that we were accepted into the cohort. And I think there's such value to that kind of collaboration amongst different institutions that all see common intentions and common goals. Because, you know, it's not unlike NACADA, where no matter which students you're serving, everybody's looking for their students to be successful, right? They're looking for their students to gain a credential, whether it's a certificate or it's a degree or whatever. They're looking to help students meet their goals. They're looking for students to have connections and human experiences with the institution and with the advisors, in particular for NACADA. And so this is our really exciting project because it, in some ways, forces us out of our comfort zone because it's looked at through a lens outside of our own. So it's not, you know, strategic planning and accreditation is often looked at from the lens of how do we see us? But this allows for us to be challenged in those assumptions and to question for ourselves, what what would this look like through the lens of another institution? What would it look like from these people who don't know my institution and don't know anything about us? So we, as I mentioned earlier, we literally launch today. From the time that you and I are recording this, it's less than 2 hours to our launch of that project. And so the from now until 2023, this will be a major project for our institution and really looking at how we're able to move forward as an institution to better serve our students.
It sounds fascinating. And what I love about it is what it sounds like sometimes, not all the time, but higher ed can be really good at policies, but maybe not implementing procedures. And it sounds like that the aim of this is very much on the procedure, like implementing those procedures and ensuring that the policies are made real. And it's also fascinating to me that here we are recording this in October 2021, and we've mentioned two projects that, you know, will kind of be coming to fruition in 2023. So we're can't be that far until we really are talking about the 2030 plans.
Yep.
Karen, we could probably talk for another hour and there'd still be lots to say. For listeners who, you know, want to get in touch with you, to get more info, insights, is there a way that people can reach out to you?
Sure, absolutely. The only challenge with it is being able to spell my last name, because it's, you know, that's always everybody's challenge. But anyone is welcome to email me at it's my first initial and last name, so krshambo@rcbc.edu. I would say to find me on social media, but I am horrible at keeping up with Twitter. I do have, you know, you tweet me or you message me on Twitter and I'll see it, but I'm awful about keeping up with it. But that's KL_Arshambo on Twitter. And I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram. Most of it is quite honestly, you know, pictures of my kid because I think she's pretty cute. Otherwise, I'm always interested in hearing from folks and would love to continue that conversation.
Perfect. And your name will be in the show notes, so they will Perfect. Be able to get the spelling, so it'll be good. Really, all that remains at this point, Karen, is to thank you for taking the time to chat to me and to wish you continued success in your career.
Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you in person sometime soon, hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Yep.
I always enjoy speaking with Karen. She's a fountain of knowledge, and I thought she shared some great insights into mentoring, self-care, and avoiding burnout. It was also fascinating to hear about her work and the various projects she's currently undertaking. I want to leave you with an old Irish blessing. May the most you hope for be the least you get. And a little bit of the Irish language. So I'll say slán go fóill, which means goodbye for now.
That will do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to each episode. We truly appreciate it. If you don't follow us already, check us out on social media, Advising Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. Head on over and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Adventures in Advising. And of course, subscribe to this podcast and stay up to date on all the episodes coming out every first and third Monday of the month. Take care, sending positive vibes your way. And for those of us that are in spring registration or soon will be, we got this, okay? Take it one student at a time, one day at a time. Take care and keep advising. Don't wanna complication.